You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, also on the Beautiful Game Network, and brought to you by Icarus FC and Roughneck Scarves. I am joined now by my friend who has a baby and a dog and a lot going on in his life, Daniel Sperry. We are down to just three games left in the MLS's back tournament. Feels like it started yesterday.
Yeah, and all of the fun, exciting teams to root for are out of it. So it'll be a blast talking about this. The remaining three games of now the miserable MLS is back. No, I'm just kidding. All the games were good, or the quarterfinals. It's okay. There's no like team that like you just sit left, that you just sit there and you're like, man, I just love watching them play soccer. That's none of these teams left. And that's really, really hard to deal with. So, yeah, man, MLS.
You haven't found Philly fun to watch in this tournament?
At times, you know, honestly, Brennan Aaronson against Sporting Kansas City was the best moment for me that Philly's had this entire tournament. If Brennan Aaronson continues to play like that, then I think Philly would be stupid fun to watch all the time. But if he can also continues to play like that, I don't think he'll be here beyond like end of January. August. Yeah. Okay. Or January.
I don't know. I think that for me is more a question of what team in Europe wants to spend money on him, because obviously it's probably the worst kept secret within the union organization right now that they're fielding offers and calls and interest from him and to a lesser extent center back Mark McKenzie. And so I think right now it's the question is what number does Philly have in their mind? For Brendan Aaronson, if the club is coming to him and saying, hey, are you interested in moving? What type of environment, either country, atmosphere, club culture, opportunities to play immediately or getting loaned out would he be interested in? And then what clubs would be able to provide both of those things? So the money so matching the transfer fee that Philly would want for him, maybe a sell-on clause or something like that. And then what opportunities would match for him? I don't know enough about the clubs that I think would fit in that market. So like Bundesliga 2, lower half of the first division in Germany. Somebody who isn't Ajax, Feyenoord, maybe Utrecht, the usual suspects in Norway would come to mind. Most of the English Championship, potentially the right club with the right immediate loan opportunity in the Premier League. And those, at least based on what we've seen initially in the transfer dealings, are the clubs that are still struggling financially. So, you know, does a club that seems like a perfect fit from Brendan Aaronson's standpoint where everybody would say yes to it, is that the club that maybe has an extra $1 million to overpay to outbid somebody else for his services from the union? Is that a number that the union would want? Those are the questions that I have regarding that. But to get back to your original point, Dan, I agree with you. In the right moment, so when we talk about a player being like a match of the day player, Dan, in that they look fantastic. If you're looking at the 5 or the 10 minute highlights of the game, they look like a huge deal. But on a whole of the 90 minutes, they don't do anything else. You know, it's like the comedy movie that uses all of their best jokes in the previews, for example. And yes. So I would agree with you that on a 10-minute highlight reel, the Philadelphia Union look really exciting. Over the course of 5 minutes, the Portland Timbers look great. I'd say similarly of the chaos that Orlando City creates, I would say Minnesota is the most team that I want to watch intently for 90 minutes, either because of what they're doing tactically, the types of players they have, things that they can give up to the other team, things that they can do to the other team. They're exciting. But the reality is that we're probably just going to see Orlando City be extremely pragmatic against the Minnesota United, and it could create chaos that is fun to watch for 5 minute highlights, is not as exciting for 10 minutes. And there's a good possibility at the end of a half, we're like, God, that was so in that regard, this is kind of like the dream scenario for Brian Smetzer and Greg Vanney, because it's four relatively pragmatic teams that are comfortable playing effective but aesthetically ugly games of soccer. So with that, Mark, let's get into it, and we'll start with I'll throw it to you first. Let's talk about Sporting Kansas City and the Philadelphia Union, the Brendan Aaronson show, but also I think some peak Peter Vermes content in the second half that kind of summed up the way Sporting started this game.
Yeah, I think so. Sporting Kansas City lost to Philadelphia Union, as mentioned, 3-1. Brendan Aaronson was the only one, was outside of a couple of goofball errors from Sporting Kansas City, Brendan Aaronson was the main reason why Philadelphia won this game. No one, Sergio Santos finished off chances, yes. No one else on that team, though, was as influential in creating attack as Brendan Aaronson was. And Sporting Kansas City wasn't really prepared for that movement. Also, their entire left side of the field was a complete wash. Luis Martins, left back, was subbed off at halftime for Phoenix Rising standout Amadou Dia, who was fantastic in his 45 minutes out there. I thought he was great, did a really good job locking things down and providing enough in attack going forward. They didn't pay a whole lot of money for Martins, so if Dia ends up replacing him, that's not a bad thing necessarily. That just means Sporting Kansas City went out and picked the best USL left back and threw him in and made him a left back at MLS level, which shouldn't shock you. Overall, Philadelphia Union came into this game, and for the first 20 minutes, each team was kind of at the same level of intensity. It wasn't super high in attack. It wasn't super low either. Sporting Kansas City were pressuring very well. There was a lot of different little pressing triggers. They were trying to invite Philadelphia out so they could try and catch them a little faster on the counter. And then when Philadelphia broke them down, it took Sporting Kansas City about 30 minutes to get back into the game. That right there was kind of what happened. Sporting Kansas City then were pushing numbers up for a corner kick. Whatever happened in the communication for who was marking on the backside of Sporting Kansas City, twice they gave up goals off a set piece where the set piece didn't do anything, and then it went down the other way and well beyond, and they got scored on a breakaway. This is a trend that we actually saw with Sporting Kansas City last year when Graham Zusi was taking corner kicks, and then Johnny Russell ended up taking corner kicks. Graham Zusi got put back more on a defensive duty, so you didn't have your right back over on the left corner, the far left attacking corner taking corner kicks. It didn't make sense, and Sporting Kansas City kind of mopped that up. After that was a common way for them to give up goals or to surrender attacking chances down their end in 2017 and 2018. So they momentarily fixed that up until that night against Philadelphia. Philadelphia exploited it. They did a great job. Biggest thing I saw when Philadelphia broke, the moment that they picked up the ball off those set pieces, the moment they broke, they had four players streaking forward, trying to get numbers forward and get down Sporting Kansas City's throat as quick as possible. Sporting Kansas City players were always second to react. Peter Vermes quoted after the game and said, "When players aren't ready to play these kind of games, that's on me." And I get that in terms of, like, yes, Peter should have motivated them and got them prepared to play this game. However, if you're a player and you need any sort of outside, like, there shouldn't be a whole lot of outside motivation that you need to get up for a knockout game. And I think that's the hard part that I have with the idea of, you know, you can blame Vermes maybe for getting it tactically wrong and trying to do a few nuanced things that weren't correct. However, the players themselves have to get up for that. And if you're not going to get up for it for those 30 minutes, and it's a common theme for Daniel Sperry's teams and Sporting Kansas City and the Earthquakes, we'll talk about later too. But if you're not up for a knockout game, I have questions about you as a player. Gianluca Busio got subbed at halftime. There were tons of European scouts paying attention to this game. And guess what? Brendan Aaronson, absolute star. Gianluca Busio didn't do very much. Wasn't able to pick up the ball in places to get forward and do stuff. Granted, he had Martinez, their Darlington Nagbe wannabe defensive midfielder who just hacks people to pieces. I can't remember his first name, but his last name is Martinez. He's number eight. He kind of sits out another deep, and he just marked Gianluca Busso the entire game and said, you're not going to get the ball. You're not going to get an inch of space. They're going to attempt to play through you, and that's not going to happen. Mark McKenzie picked up Pulido. Somebody else picked up the rest of the runners, and they effectively shut down Sporting Kansas City's attack pretty easily. And I look at the job that Philadelphia Union did, not only in snuffing out Sporting Kansas City's attacking plans, but they also did a really good job of managing the end of the match. That for me was a key. I'll make one last quick note. Sporting Kansas City made a couple subs at halftime. They had two massive chances. One, Alan Pulido with a free kick that goes off literally almost too perfect upper 90 because it hit off the corner of the crossbar, where the crossbar and the upright meet. Hit there, didn't go in. Could have been a goal. That could have made it 3-2. Also, a very, very good save from Andre Blake, where Johnny Russell cuts down the end line, cuts it back in. Pulido's shot gets saved. Ball gets put back in on the rebound, but Johnny Russell was offside at the moment that the shot was taken. So then that takes him out of the play. If Blake doesn't make that save and Alan Pulido's shot is maybe 4 inches lower, we're talking about a very, very potentially very different outcome and a 3-3 game with about 30 minutes left to play in that second half. Those two moments were huge because Sporting Kansas City had a ton of momentum going at halftime and after the fact. And those two plays, not being able to get those done, sealed it for Sporting Kansas City, because at the end of it, they would push so much forward and they weren't able to get back into it to make up for their really poor early mistakes.
Yeah, the player you were thinking of, Jose Hernandez, Jose is his first name, and I'd agree with you in terms of describing his style of play. He's basically MLS Eastern Conference Diego Chará, and I thought that he was absolutely fantastic in that game against
Sporting Kansas City. Did I say Darlington Nagbe?
Darlington Nagbe.
Oh, yeah, I totally meant Diego Chará. Holy cow, yeah.
Okay. Okay, yes. 100%. I feel like that's worse than me mispronouncing Jose.
It might be.
So in any case, I thought, this game was all about transition play. And I think this tournament, similar to with San Jose and Matias Almeida, has been just with the structure of playing, every 4 to 5 days, just getting focused in on training, having players in the bubble comes with it, an absence of distractions that you would normally have between traveling and in your home market. And everything is really allowed some teams to kind of come through and have their tactical ideas really and gel from a tactical standpoint and just have those come to fruition. And I think the Union is a great example of this. And I thought in that game against Sporting Kansas City, and to a lesser extent the game against New York City FC, were kind of just like, this is the pinnacle of the blueprint that Jim Curtin has been working on under the new regime for the last, two, maybe 3 years now. And I think we finally see that come through in terms of the players that they've added, players who've adjusted in terms of what the plan and what their role was before to what it is now. I thought Alejandro Bedoya had a fantastic game. I thought Kai Wagner was also excellent. And this is just a team that's drilling well, and they've kind of staked out, okay, like, this is what our plan's going to be. We're going to be defensively stout. We're going to be really, really good in transition. And we've got a couple relatively inexpensive players in Shabilko and Sergio Santos that we're just going to focus on creating high quality opportunities for those players, because we don't have a distinct match winner. And because, we're going to play in a way that doesn't give ourselves immediate weaknesses. And I think the theme that we've seen in this tournament, Dan, compared to a regular season. In a regular season, you're focused on what can we do well, what can we do to make the other team uncomfortable such that over the course of a 34-game season, we play well enough. And really in these knockout round games, as we've seen in Gold Cup knockout round games, as we've seen even from the first whistle at a World Cup, that it's about what can you do to not make mistakes? What can you do to take advantage of your opponent's mistakes when they make those mistakes? And in that, I think all four teams that we are going to see in these semifinals have been extremely clinical in that regard. And I think that makes up for how well Philadelphia Union have played. I think it's certainly a disappointing result for Sporting Kansas City, but I guess the big question that I have about this was just the decision to bench or the unavailability of Matt Beisler, because he and Tim Melia were kind of that last, you know, they're the pillars of what that team is defensively, and not starting him in a knockout round game is really a question from me that I didn't fully understand given what was at stake and given ultimately what we saw from the Philly's attack against the Sporting Kansas City center backs. But let us move on, Dan, to the other game, to our other quarterfinal game that we had, and that was Orlando City SC taking on LAFC. I thought this was a game, you know, kind of similar to the Sounders match from the playoffs last year, where LAFC had a bunch of opportunities. They could have ended it at any given time, and they just weren't able to get that. And Orlando, to an extent, parked the bus as soon as the game was made 1-1, and it was really clear one team was going for the win, one team was going for PKs, and it was just about them hoping that they could win in PKs. And ultimately, I guess, you know, the theme of the quarterfinal stand was pragmatism wins the day, and I don't think any team was more pragmatic or just committed to, we'll take the coin flip in PKs rather than getting torn apart like every other team against LAFC, and that was Orlando City.
Yeah, I'm going to look at this real quick. One, you've got Oscar Pareja, who is a very, very good defensive tactical person. FC Dallas under Oscar Pareja was one of the most difficult, annoying, petulant teams to play against. They frustrated anybody who wanted to come in and play gorgeous, free-flowing, attractive attacking soccer. Got stifled for a good portion of Oscar Pareja's tenure with FC Dallas. So now he goes to Orlando, who is actually spending money compared to FC Dallas. A little bit different thing. Yes, they want to bring up young players through their system. However, they're not as focused on that being the end game. And I don't know how many times Pareja lost a good player and never got them replaced. And they said, hey, here's a 17-year-old academy kid. Good luck replicating your, Supporters Shield FC Dallas team. I feel like he got hung out to dry a lot in Dallas, despite the great things that Dallas are doing. Now, we look at what he's at with Orlando. Pedro Gallese, probably one of the better goalkeepers in MLS to be picked up this offseason. In my opinion, he's way better than Kenneth Vermeer, way better than a few of the others have entered the league. He honestly might enter the league and be a top five goalkeeper in the league. Great shot stopper. He, Orlando, under Luis Muzzi, being in the area, João Moutinho has come to life. Jackson Mendes was the defensive midfielder that played along Uri Rosell for this and was fantastic. You also have Mueller, Mauricio Pereira. Chris Mueller's turned on well. Akindele is a very good hold-up and combined striker. Nani is freaking Nani. And Mauricio Pereira has been a rumored MLS designated player for years. Ends up coming to Orlando City. On the bench, you have Junior Urso, who is a top midfielder from Corinthians. You've got Robinho, who's not bad. Andres Pereira, Benji Michel has been fine. There's a lot of players in this team that Oscar Pereja that fit exactly what Oscar Pereja would want to do as a head coach. He wants two midfielders that are very good defensively, very good at spraying the ball wide. He's got two wingers who are very good at getting wide and getting balls into the box for service. He's also got defenders that execute the game plan perfectly. They have grown into the system. And you've got very good players, like I said, with that are executing this system. You know, a tactician like Pareja to take the team that he has and frustrate the crap out of LAFC isn't surprising. And it shouldn't be surprising to the longtime MLSers, especially those who know FC Dallas from their original Oscar Pareja days when they had Mauro Diaz and Fabian Castillo and even Tesho Akindele as well there. Oscar Pareja set this team up perfectly to annoy and frustrate LAFC. Guess what? The better team won this game. And LAFC put up 8 shots. Orlando City put up 17 shots. 52% possession for Orlando City. You go all on down the line. Duels won. They almost matched LAFC. LAFC did have the edge on that and on tackles won, but they had less of the ball. You know, I will say this, 17 fouls in a game, did a great job of frustrating. That's a very Oscar Pereja thing to do, though. Yep. Absolutely frustrate, hack him to death. That's how Pereja's teams always took it to teams that came into the game that wanted to play beautiful, free-flowing, attacking soccer. And especially a team like LAFC that doesn't capitalize on possession as much as they capitalize on the transition moments, to be able to foul them and hack them to death in the transition moments. That is a proven recipe for success against LAFC. That's what Peter Vermes has done against them every single time. And they've been borderline winners in all of those matches. So I applaud Orlando City for doing this, but I really do think that the better team won in this. The second half, it was all Orlando City. Yes, they were pushing for a goal, but in reality, it was all Orlando City in the second half. They put up 17 shots. I know they only had 5 on target, but they at least attempted 17 shots, more than twice as much as what LAFC put out there. And so props to Orlando City for getting the job done. I know it was penalty kicks. I don't know what Bob Bradley was pissed off about. I know Luis Nani was living it up with those PKs. But I ultimately, I'm happy that Orlando moved on, and I'm happy that Orlando is good. I really am.
Yeah, no, definitely a couple good notes and corrections there, Dan. But, you know, I think, like, let's talk about LAFC, where they had an opponent show them some things that they weren't necessarily expecting, didn't have them roll over, and ultimately this was an opportunity. You know, it's kind of ironic. Like, is Orlando City now the bogey team for LAFC? Because before they couldn't get over the LA Galaxy. As soon as they get over the LA Galaxy, they lose to the Seattle Sounders. They slay the dragon against Seattle Sounders, but then they lose to Orlando City. So this is still an extremely high quality team. This is a team that, you know, I thought got a tough result last year when they got knocked out by Seattle Sounders, but clearly weren't the best team. And this was another game to where on another day, or if Orlando City was only operating at 90% of what they did in this game against LAFC, I think LAFC tries to find a way and ultimately gets a victory in regular time for me, or at the very least, maybe you don't have Jordan Harvey take a PK and then have him miss it and that be the reason that you're out of the tournament. But, you know, I agree with you, Dan. Props to Orlando City. And they're, you know, they weren't the fun team that played. They didn't play football in the same way that LAFC played football, but LAFC wasn't completely at their sharpest level. I think, or like, that was the peak. I don't think Orlando City could have done a better job than what they executed outside of giving up the goal to Bradley Wright Phillips. So peak Orlando City FC against LAFC without Carlos Vela, being slightly inefficient, being slightly careless, having Jordan Harvey take your second PK of all players, and then have a team that maybe, you know, was looking at it from the standpoint of like, yeah, we slayed the dragon against Seattle Sounders, now it's going to be easy, which is basically exactly what befell them last year when they played LAFC. So I wonder, you know, is LAFC going to make it to an MLS Cup and then lose to Orlando City? Like, is this a passing of this is the bogey team we can't mentally get over? I guess it's beneficial that Orlando plays in the East compared to, you know, Zlatan and the LA Galaxy, and certainly compared to Seattle Sounders. But let's move on to the third game that we have, Dan. San Jose Earthquakes against Minnesota United FC. Minnesota United FC pressed the crap out of San Jose in the first half, and then when they were in possession, they spread San Jose out, creating these wide channels that then where there were opportunities in individual mashups. Minnesota was absolutely able to take advantage of that. Dan, your thoughts on the hopeless Minnesota United taking on a team that would challenge Liverpool for the trophy right now in San Jose? Thoughts on Minnesota United getting a result and maybe providing a blueprint for teams that have struggled in the past with Matias Almeida and San Jose Earthquakes and their man-marking scheme?
Yeah, I mean, the underdogs, just a valiant underdog effort to just get this.
So hopeless. Man. How did they win this game, Dan? How did Minnesota United not lose this game 32-0 as the hopeless underdog against the giant juggernaut San Jose Earthquakes that would beat Pele's Brazil right now?
My goodness, man.
Like, Adrian Heath, I hope you're listening to this.
I'm so tired of it, man. I really am tired of the underdog mentality. At some point, stand up and say, hey, we're good. I understand nobody's talking about it, but there's all to me, there's also something about putting your head down and just working and not really caring. You know, you want to use it as bulletin board material, fine. But, like, to constantly come out and just be like, oh, nobody believes in us in the media when we're asking about, why is your team so good? Oh, well, nobody believes in us. Literally just said your team's good, buddy. It gets old, but you're right. On to the match, tactical talk on this one. Benny Failhaber, I asked, how do you last year, Sporting Kansas City beat a beleaguered Sporting Kansas City, came from behind on San Jose Earthquakes at home and won 2-1. Benny Failhaber scored this insane left foot golazo volley that he's like, I don't know if I could ever do that again in my life. I asked him after the game, I said, how do you beat him? How do you beat the man marking thing? And he goes, you have to win your one-on-one battles. The moment you win your one-on-one battles, then you can go and get forward and do that. Sporting Kansas City also did a really good job in that game of forcing the majority of San Jose's touches to be within their own half. And they forced them to play within their own half. Well, Minnesota United took that blueprint, took it a little one step further, and really forced San Jose to spread out as much as they could. They took the ball in their half, and when they had the ball, they spread out and forced all of the space for a San Jose Earthquakes team that isn't as fast as they were last year. I think at times they're fine, but sometimes, like Magnus Harrison, not the fastest dude. Vaco doesn't play defense, not the fastest dude. And then their two center backs are, you know, it's like multiple Dejan Lovrens, but like just like really, really slow, big brute defenders, very good one-on-one defenders, but not fast defenders. So you like to play that system perfectly, you need like an entire back line of Ico Paras, and they don't have that. They don't remotely have that. So what Minnesota did is really spread them out and then use speed. There's players in this game that we haven't seen much of. Hassani Dotson, Ja'Cory Hayes was in the game. There was a lot of guys that were playing last night. There were guys that you haven't seen in a while, but they went pace. Luis Amaria, fast. Through the middle, Robin Laud played well. Kevin Molino played well. There was a lot of players that played really well, but they chose to be just a little bit more pacey, a little bit more on the front foot in the attack than what they normally would, and they did a good job of using that pace to win the one-on-one battles, not only on the ball, but off the ball. If you can win your one-on-one battle off the ball, get him off of you, find the space. The more space you create, the more space you have to run in. The more space that you have means they're not marking you, which means their entire system falls apart the moment, can potentially fall apart the moment that one player is beat, because then it either forces somebody else to step up or that player gets to take the shot. And the Minnesota United did a really good job of that. Also, set pieces. San Jose has been really suspect on set pieces for a while anyways. And I thought Minnesota capitalized on that one as well. So job well done tactically to Minnesota United. However, they were favorites by Vegas going into the match. They have not lost to the San Jose Earthquakes since the very, very first time that they played them. This is back on Midway. At Midway, at the old Minnesota Gophers Stadium where they were playing, I can't remember the name, TCF Bank Stadium, right?
TCF Bank Stadium, yeah.
So they were playing. But I mean, the San Jose Earthquakes have not.
Was this Taheem Devendov era Minnesota United, Dan?
Yeah. Okay. Actually, it was Mikael. The last time that they beat Minnesota United was Mikael Stare era San Jose Earthquakes. Actually, that was the only those two games against Minnesota that year were the two of the four wins they had on that entire season. But yeah, that's the last time they've beaten them. So Minnesota United routinely beats them, was the favorite in the game, and won 4-1. I mean, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it anymore. Guess what? Guess who's favorites for their semifinal matchup against Orlando?
All right, good point there, Dan. You know, I agree with everything that you said. You know, I think this is the... We saw this last year in the long-term scale, where Matias Almeida just wasn't really flexible in adjusting his system and also didn't really have a distinct counterpunch when things weren't working well. And so in this game, I think once you could see, you know, 30 minutes in, I can't remember what the score line was at that point, so I'll look that up while I'm doing this. But in any case, you know, where you needed to see some form of an adjustment from San Jose, you know, so for example, if you are the New York Red Bulls and you really, really love to press the crap out of the opponent, well, okay, what do you do when they just choose to not have the ball and sit back and counterattack? So you need to have a second move, a second look. And I think at MLS, you need to have that both in the offensive phase and you also need that in the defensive phase. And transition can vary depending on what you're doing in those other phases as well. So, you know, it's 22 minutes in. Jacory Hayes has just made it 2-1 to Minnesota. Both goals have come off of the pressing San Jose in the attack high up the field and then also spreading things out to create that space. And you need some sort of an adjustment. And so, you know, I realized that the man marking system that Matias Almeida has is very, very, it's much harder to transition to anything that still remotely looks like that without having it be completely different, you know? So it's like in, like how you have in college football, for example, or yeah, let's say college football, where you're a team that was running for, you had a head coach and the head coach left, and for 7 years under that head coach, you were running the triple option. And then you have, you know, how do you transition from the triple option to anything else in throw ball other than maybe an I formation with a two back set? But even then, you've got to incorporate a passing game. Similarly, going from, you know, five wide into anything that isn't just the air raid offense is extremely difficult. So I don't know how in game you make adjustments to, okay, what we're doing from a man marking scheme isn't really working. There's no real easy little adjustments that you can do. You have to completely change things. So I can understand that, but this game was kind of a microcosm of that, where when it works, it's fantastic. When it works and it creates chaos, and San Jose can take advantage of that in terms of what I was saying before about we don't make a whole lot of mistakes. We can't control our opponents making mistakes, but we can take advantage of that. When San Jose is at their best, they are a very good team at that. We saw glimpses and moments where I could say in the when MLS restarts the regular season, San Jose can be a playoff team in that regular season format. But we also saw glimpses of where this was still a team that is kind of rigidly focused in their move. And if their one, you know, if their first move doesn't really work, they don't really have a counter move or an adjustment. And so that's something that still, based on what I've seen, I'm not sure that Matias Almeida understands that. I'm not sure if he's comprehended to the point where let's actually work in training on a plan that isn't that. But that is going to be, that is a flaw. When it's great, it's great. When it's bad, it's bad. And that's potentially something that could be, you know, the Achilles heel of the San Jose Earthquakes in the Almeida era. Let's move on to the final game that we have in the quarterfinals, Dan. And that was last night, New York City FC taking on Portland Timbers. And kind of, I feel like every single game we've seen from the Timbers in this tournament, Dan, is the exact same, where it's just they're extremely pragmatic. They sit deep, they counterattack, and it's ultimately about can we be clinical with our opportunities, understanding that we're probably going to have to outperform the X goal analytics in order to get a result. And then it's just about can Ibo Bisse finish one of the four or five chances that he gets? Could Diego Valeri or one of the other substitutes have an impact? And it's basically been the exact same game, the exact same game that I've watched throughout this tournament. And in that, it's just very, very prototypical Portland under Savarese.
Yeah. I'm really tired of Portland in the sense that, like, their Christmas tree thing works, but it's so frustrating because a lot of it works on their ability to break down the other team in transition by the way of Diego Chara incessantly fouling people and never getting any retribution for it. I think last night, as much as we all talked about the FA Cup earlier in the day, where we thought the FA Cup, basically, you know, Anthony Taylor, the referee, should have had a winner's medal in that one. Penalty kick was bogus. The contact started outside the box, carried in. A pathetic call on Mateo Kovacic to send him off, etc., etc., etc. Missed the Martinez goalkeeper standing outside of the box with the ball, well out outside of the box. I look at this game, and I'm not going to entirely blame the result on Robert Sobeika. But what Robert Sobeika did was constantly let Portland just body people off the ball, in transition. Any single time someone took an in cut, they were stepping on their ankle. And I don't know how many times I watched Robert Sobeika just look at the dude and motion to get up. There, you go back and look on the replays. Guess what? Slow down. Look, dude got stepped on. Dude had his ankle crunched. Nico Castellanos is annoying as heck. He is a petulant forward. He's always moving, getting under the people's skin. However, Diego Chara, Eric Williamson and co. stepped on his ankle and while he had the ball about 10 times last night. There were so many times where Portland gets this like leash with the referees for their physical play because, oh, well, it's Diego Chara. He's going to be physical. And it's kind of ridiculous. And when referees don't give them their leash, then their ability to break down other teams and break stop other teams' attack starts to go away because then they, okay, well, we got yellows in their mind. But the fact that then for Sobeika to not give Eric Williamson a deserved second yellow, a very deserved second yellow, then reinforces the idea that, well, anybody can do anything here. We won't get sent off. And I think that right there is where those are ways where a referee has a pretty big impact on a game without making the big call incorrectly. He got the penalty kick call correct, in my opinion. Some people don't believe it, but at some point when you go through the dude, push him over, hack him, step on his foot inside the box, that's a foul. That's what by law, those are like three different fouls that all occurred to create said penalty kick. However, Portland did a really good job on the counterattack when they had the ball of getting through, and they always create decent chances. And when you have players like Diego Valeri, when you have players, you know, I'm throwing away the Andy Polo goal because in my opinion, it was a fantastic goal, but it was not a direct, like a huge effect on it. It doesn't fit it doesn't fit the narrative, but it's like a garbage time goal. You're like, okay, that was a dope shot. It was great, but it's not a product of what Portland was really trying to do. Portland is not trying to score 35-yard bangers, curling them in the upper corner every single time. You know, what they're trying to do is score the goals that Sebastian Blanco and Diego Valeri scored. And when you have dudes like that, that are in those positions, that are able to take those chances, more often than not, even despite the fact that they are low XG chances, good players always have best strikers either match their expected goal differential or surpass it. And I guarantee you, if you go back and look at some of like the advanced stats on Sebastian Blanco and Diego Valeri, I bet for their career in their MLS that they've scored more goals than they are supposed to. But that's because they are clinical finishers. They are very good. If you give them a sniff at goal around the 18-yard box, you better believe there's a good chance that that ball is going to be on frame, and an even better chance that that ball might be in the back of the net. And I think what Portland does is they give those guys great chances. And what last year, where they were so lethal for a while, is because they also had Brian Fernandez, Stephen A. Smith. He was on crack meme. Yep. But, you know, when he was in there, he was scoring goals left and right because he was also the clinical finisher. I think that's what makes Portland dangerous. If they can figure out a way to get Niyozgoda, Ibobise, Sebastian Blanco and Diego Valeri all on the field at the same time, honestly think maybe just sacrifice Yimi Chara. I know you spent a lot of money for him, but he hasn't been that impressive for me. That team could be really, really, really dangerous in my opinion. So I'd love to see Portland do that. I'm going to stop rambling about Portland now, but those goals there are the exact product that Portland wants in their attack. And that is why they always outperform their expected goals, is because they have great shot takers, great finishers taking low chance shots, and they convert more often than not because they're of that level of quality.
Yeah, and this is also the only thing that I really have to add, Dan, is this is the kind of the tournament and the schedule and the way it's set up is also set up for if you are a team that is hot, that has attackers that are confident, that are playing well, that are finishing, you can roll through. Whereas through a regular season, you know, for example, you know, this tournament might have it be where Portland has a 10-game unbeaten run, and then also another 2 months where they're absolutely terrible. And so in the absence of, you know, just, again, sample size, you know, we've played, what, the three group stage games, the round of 16, the quarterfinals, you know, these teams have played 5 games so far. Seeing Portland, aware if Sebastian Blanco and Diego Valeri and Jeremy Ibobese are hot, can they, you know, go 5 games unbeaten, have a 5-game winning streak in an MLS season? Yes, over the course of a 34-game season and a larger sample size, inevitably, if you are overperforming, you will regress to the mean. If you are underperforming, you will progress to the mean. And so we'll see that a little bit more balanced out, but that's not how this tournament works, and that's ultimately not how you get rewarded in this tournament. So I think my question for San Jose going into this round that we're talking about, the quarterfinals and beyond, was at what point was somebody going to come up with a plan that was going to make the man marking scheme uncomfortable, or at what point were they just going to run out of gas because they all run a million miles a game? And so we kind of saw that a little bit the first option there with Minnesota United. My question still with the Portland Timbers is, what happens if the strikers go cold? What happens if they don't have somebody finish games and then they're not able to dictate the game by scoring that first goal? And so that's the question that I have, because we haven't really had to see a little bit for maybe like 20, 30 minutes against LAFC. We haven't seen the Portland Timbers when things aren't going according to plan. We haven't seen them had to adjust. Whereas we saw the San Jose Earthquakes, you know, for the better part of 60 minutes, have to play when things weren't necessarily going their way. We've seen Orlando in this tournament when they've been uncomfortable. We've seen Philly's mostly handled things pretty well. We've seen Minnesota United when they've been uncomfortable in other games as well, playing against Columbus Crew the way that they did, having to play against RSL when they really made it an ugly game. You know, those first 80 minutes against Sporting Kansas City. How much different of a story are we talking about this tournament and about Sporting Kansas City and Minnesota United if Melia doesn't have to come off his line and get a red card for Dogso? If Sporting Kansas City wins that game, or maybe that doesn't open the door for Minnesota United to get a little bit of confidence as the hopeless, worthless underdogs that they are. With that, Dan, let's head on to the semifinal preview. I will throw it to you first. Philadelphia Union taking on Portland Timbers, two teams that are very pragmatic, two teams that aren't fun to watch necessarily, and two teams that are going to care all about transition play.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to a little bit of my argument on Portland on this one. About why Portland's thing works, as frustrating as it is that they have higher quality players putting those chances away. But the other thing on the hindsight is Philadelphia's system is very, very unique. Not many places have two defensive midfielders pushing you all over the place, two strikers, that four-two-one-two thing, or the diamond midfield. It has been very, very difficult for a lot of teams to deal with. And I'm curious to see the matchup here, because you got Christmas Tree versus Diamond, right? Technically, Portland is probably going to put more players in the middle of the park than Philadelphia are. However, does what Philadelphia do in the press frustrate Portland more so? In this one, I'm inclined to lean a little bit more towards Portland because Sebastian Blanco, Diego Valeri. A lot of people like Philadelphia to win this tournament in the long run. I think there are ways that they can get them, but one, Kasper Schmelko has to be a lot better. He needs to be back to his form that he was last year. And two, Brennan Aaronson needs to be the type of difference maker that he was, against Sporting Kansas City for about 30 minutes or so there. If Brennan Aaronson is like that, Kasper Schmelko's finishing chances, I think Portland or Philadelphia have this one. However, Brennan Aaronson is really going to need to find some space and some ways to create against that Portland midfield of Williamson and Diego Chara. They will hack him to pieces as much as they can before and take the leash from whatever referee is on that game as long as it can possibly go. So that's going to be the big thing. Brennan Aaronson needs to show up, because at times he kind of ends up outside of the flow of the game, and looks like he's just kind of on the outside looking in. But when he is on the ball and dominant and moving and running at players and making things happen and playing those balls in, then he's really dangerous. So if Portland can contain Brendan Aaronson. I actually think I would take Portland in this one, but if like I said, it's gonna go, it's gonna come down to Portland being the, letting the game state be the type of way that it wants to, that they need it to be, and also those chances that Sebastian Blanco, Diego Valeri get, are they gonna put them away? Because they're not going to get the Andy Polo screamer every single game.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Dan, this game for me is all about two players and the zones they operate. Have you, Dan, have you either been listening recently to the MLS Assist podcast, or did you watch the Amazon documentary series on Manchester City?
I have done neither.
You've done neither. Okay, so when we talk about Pep Guardiola and the zones, the way that he looks at in terms of having, you know, no two players, no more than two players are lined up vertically and horizontally with each other, and ultimately that's about preventing pockets of space to create for the opponent, and that also creates easy passing lanes for your players without having people have to clump up just to create passing triangles to get out of a press or switch the field or something like that. Thing that Manchester City and Pep Guardiola emphasize strongly is both the defensive and the offensive red zone, as they call it, saying this is somebody who where was I going with this? Okay, so they don't watch American football, so obviously we think red zone, we think something very different. And so MLS Assist basically coined it the Manchester City zone. And so that is the zone, Dan, you have. So at the top of the box,
well, think about zone 14, correct?
One of those is zone 14, but then the red zone is more of a conceptual fluid spaces, and that is the space between the midfield line and the center back line, or at the very least the pocket of space around a central defensive player, if that indeed is how the opponent is playing. So this is the area where one of Sergio Aguero or Kevin De Bruyne are always looking to get the ball to, or create and expand that actual space. And so when you were just talking about who did Portland play? I don't have the New York City FC. When you talk about disrupting that, who is the disruptor? I don't think there's a better disruptor of that zonal space, that space between the lines centrally in MLS, than Diego Chará. And just from a few minutes ago, I was comparing Jose Martinez to Diego Chará. So this is all about, for me, who is able to find the Manchester City zone, and who is able, which one of those two players, Martinez for Philly against Portland and Diego Chará for Portland against Philly, is able to disrupt the other team in their finding and exploiting the space in the red zone in the Manchester City zone. If Diego Chará is able to completely boss it, and Alejandro Bedoya and Aaron and Brendan Aaronson are not able to get there and do anything with it, then it is absolutely advantage Portland Timbers. If Jose, I just can't say names right now, folks, it's Sunday. If Jose Martinez can handle things well
You've
against
been thinking, you know, about Jose Mourinho too much.
I have been thinking about Jose Mourinho too much. He does live rent-free in my head there, Dan. If he is okay, so if Martinez, we're just gonna call Martinez, if Martinez is able to handle things against, you know, is it gonna be Sebastian Blanco, is Jeremy Bobise gonna have more of a fluid role rather than just being a number nine? Diego Valeri came off the bench for Portland. Does he start, or how many minutes does he end up playing with whoever? It's less obvious which players are going to be playing the Sergio Aguero and or Kevin De Bruyne role for the Portland Timbers, where it's pretty obvious what that, you know, it's going to be Sergio Santos, Brendan Aaronson, to a lesser extent, Ali Bedoya, and maybe he's kind of at a different role, but more Montero as well. It's obvious who is going to be doing that for Philly and how they're going to be doing about it. I'm not sure, and maybe that mystery is part of where it's maybe slight advantage Portland in this one, in terms of I don't know who is going to be doing that against Jose Martinez. So that's what this matchup's all about. Whoever ends up winning that, whoever ends up getting that, and to the extent that the officials give leeway for the dark arts of Chará and Martinez, is going to determine the outcome of the game. Let's move on to the other matchup, Dan, that is literal Lions taking on Loons as hopeless Minnesota United take on the juggernaut that is playoff Orlando City SC.
Yeah. This is going to be a fun one, because Oscar Pereira will like do whatever he can to piss off Adrian Heath, and I'm really excited for it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I haven't gone back yet to look at past Pareja versus Heath matchups. However, they're usually absolutely bonkers. I remember one, there's one where Orlando City were down like two men for red cards back when Heath was manager. This is back when they were at the Camping World Stadium, the Orange Bowl. Down 2-0 or something like that, down a man, and got like two stoppage time equalizers or something like that. Crazy stuff. This is going to be a fun one. I personally think that this Orlando team is going to be harder to deal with for Minnesota than the last ones that they dealt with, because they do like the things that will frustrate Minnesota. So if you look at the teams that have beaten Minnesota so far and have done a good job against Minnesota, technically no team has beaten Minnesota so far in this tournament. But if you look back at the Minnesota-Colorado draw, I actually think that they're kind of, Colorado and Orlando can be relatively similar at times, just in the way that their midfield likes to go about the game a bit. Jack Price reminds me a lot of Uri Rosell.
That's fair.
So I say that way. I think it's the personnel matchups that are going to be interesting, because in reality, Orlando pretty much mirrors what Minnesota does. It's pretty similar. You've got two defensive mids that roam the midfield, break stuff up, and have good passing going forward. They have a very good number. Both teams have Kevin Molino and Mauricio Pereja at the 10s. You've got Chris Mueller at the right wing and Nani at the left for Orlando. And then Tesho, who's a great player that you can play into to create chances. I think, though, Orlando is a little bit more clinical on the break than some of the teams that Minnesota have played so far. And I say, and you look at, now San Jose is a very, very good counterattacking team, but Andy Rios as a striker offers nothing in the buildup of the game. So it's all relied on the midfield and the wing play for them to get forward. Orlando relies heavily on Luis Nani and Mauricio Pereja. And then you have Chris Mueller operating almost as a second striker to your boy Tesho Akindele. Akindele's a great sponge. He soaks up the ball as it passed into him, and he can feed it off to others. I think that for the first time in a while, you've got a striker whose play and movement is really going to frustrate Jose Aja and what's his face? The other center back, Boxall.
Michael Boxall.
Yes. And then having Pereja there on the back end, and then always having to account for Luis Nani in these moments, I think kind of sets up Orlando to do the good things. Because ultimately, right now, Minnesota's like real positives are their defensive midfield, Kevin Molino, and Emeria. A little bit to be left from some of the other positions, or a little bit left to be desired from some of the other positions. I think Orlando's been firing on all cylinders this entire tournament, and that's been pretty awesome to see. So I'm going to take Orlando in this one just because I'm really tired of Minnesota. But I do think that the way the matchup goes, I think it kind of benefits Orlando City. And just in general, their elevated talent levels at the same positions and the same kind of style of players that Minnesota will be using.
Yeah, I think the thing that's really interesting about this matchup for me, Dan, is how many different players can get involved in the attack in creating a shooting opportunity or shooting themselves. You know, this for Orlando City, for example, it's not just Nani, you know, with Cash Mueller playing as his as the Robin to his Batman. You know, whether it's Benny Michel coming off the bench, somebody out of the midfield, Ruan, who for my money has been probably the best right back in this position. You know, him and, you know, this match will probably determine if we're voting for that kind of thing. You know, it's between him and Ramon Mentaner, if you ask me personally. But, you know, it's not just one striker. These are two teams that are not simple in terms of their personnel in an attacking sense. You know, if you want to get at the LA Galaxy 2 years ago, it was everything was about Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Sporting Kansas City, to a less extent, was more heavily Alan Pulido. So if I have a pie if I give two buys to the head coach and I say what percentage of, you know, give out a slice of a pie that to each player that represents their significance in terms of what they do from an attacking standpoint, in terms of trying to create goals. And I legitimately think, I don't think there's any player on those two teams that would have a majority of that pie in the way that I think, you know, Carlos Vela would have at least a third of it probably for a normal LAFC. You know, it's spread out pretty, you know, relatively evenly amongst three or four players. And then between the fullbacks and maybe one other midfielder, they get a small sliver as well. And so in that, I don't think planning, I don't think defensively either of these teams have a simple task in terms of planning for how the opponent attacks. And in that, I'm most excited about this game just once we actually get into the final thirds, and particularly once the ball is either in the box or downfield enough that it would be, you know, if we draw a line across the entire field where the top of the 18 is, in that final 18 yards between the top of the box and the end line is where I'm most excited. But I agree with you, Dan, that this could be a game that at times isn't aesthetically pleasing because of what each team is going to have to do to get the ball into that area and what the opponent is going to do to prevent that team from doing that. So, I mean, if we could just clip together a highlight reel that is just the ball inside within 18 yards of goal, I'm super excited. But, you know, maybe the whole of the 90 minutes is going to be tough in this one. I don't really know. We'll get to predictions in a couple minutes, but I'm not sure where I'm leaning in terms of who I actually like in this matchup just because of the way the two teams have played. But I am super excited. I would pay pay-per-view level money, Daniel, to have somebody stand there with a mic just between the two coaches' boxes and perfectly pick up everything that Oscar Pereja and Adrian Heath are saying to each other. Because I agree with you, this is going to be a game that is just going to be about, like, Oscar Pereja poking and annoying and trolling Adrian Heath. And Adrian Heath is punchy and he loves the banter, so I'd be excited to see what that would look like. Let's move on to predictions, Dan. We will start with the match on Wednesday, our first semifinal, Philadelphia Union taking on the Portland Timbers. This will be Wednesday the 5th at 8 p.m. Eastern on FS1. Dan, who you got and why?
I'm going to take Portland Timbers in this one. I'm going to say 2-0. And why? Because of the statement, the things that I have said beforehand. I think Diego Valeri and Sebastian Blanco are going to be clinical. I think Diego Chara is going to pretty much negate Brennan Aaronson.
Okay, I'm gonna take Portland in this one as well, but I will say 2-1. I think the Union will be able to create offense, but, you know, like I said before, this is all about the Manchester City red zone, and in that, it's gonna be all about Diego Chara and Jose Martinez. And the fact is, Diego Chara has been doing this in MLS for 5 or 6 years. He's done it in the playoffs, and Martinez is still relatively unknown. In that, I'm going to take the sure thing, and the sure thing will be Diego Chara driving Brendan Aaronson crazy and somehow not getting a yellow card despite committing 5 fouls throughout the game. Let's move on to our second semifinal. This will be on Thursday the 6th. Dan, this will be at 8 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. Orlando City SC taking on Minnesota United. Who you got and why?
I'm going to take Orlando City in this one on penalties, because Pedro Chiesa is a better goalkeeper than Tyler Miller.
Okay, I'm going to take Minnesota United in this one. I think in the net matchup of what the fullbacks are doing for both teams, I think it's going to be a slight advantage to Minnesota United. Luis Amarillo hadn't been super impressive for me up until this past game against San Jose, and he finally got off this nine, did some things both on the ball and off the ball, scored a pretty good goal that he created, that he was mostly responsible for creating. And so in that, I think Minnesota United has the bigger singular game changer than I would say what Chris Mueller or Nani are able to do individually. So by the skin of their teeth, I will take Minnesota United in a wild 3-2 game. Dan, do you have any last words? Tell people where they can find you on Twitter and tell them about one of our sponsors today.
Yeah. Folks, are you tired of the same old uniforms and cookie cutter templates from Nike and Adidas? Are you looking for a unique, completely custom kit for your youth club, Sunday league squad, adult, or even pro team? Icarus FC can help you create the kit of your dreams at an affordable price. With the motto, any design you want, seriously, let them help you design your new custom kit today at IcarusFC.com. I have no last words. You can find me on Twitter at SperryDana94. Hopefully next pod we'll be talking about a concrete plan from MLS on return to play.
Yeah. Listeners, you can follow me on Twitter at LWS Matt Pollard. In terms of last words, Dan, this coming Tuesday at 2:45 p.m. Eastern time on ESPN Plus, it is the richest game in football as Fulham FC are taking on Brentford FC in the English Championship, or I guess the promotion playoff final to get promoted from the English Championship into the Premier League. West London Derby as they're invading Wembley Stadium, albeit without any fans in the stands with the pandemic still taking place in England. Two teams that play very, very different style of football. Both teams who kind of figured things out during the pandemic. Fulham lost their first two games of the of Project Restart, one of which was to Brentford, even though it was fairly even until the end of the game. The second goal was effectively what we think about as like an empty net or a garbage time goal for Brentford, and then Brentford stumbled a little bit. Two very different styles of play. Fulham likes to play with possession. They like to get balls into their big striker, Alexander Mitrovic, whereas I would say the Brentford are Portland Timbers, and their Diego Valeri is Saeed Benrahma. So two very exciting teams, two very different teams, and I think two teams that would be an interesting and would be something new to be added to the Premier League if they get promotion. So I'm super excited to watch that game. We'll see what ends up happening. And it'll, of course, be the most expensive game in the richest game in football in an era where I think both teams could certainly use some financial support going into their next season. So with that, I want to thank our other sponsor, Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier of MLS, USL, and US Scarves. Get your custom scarf for your group or team at roughneckscarves.com. Roughneck Scarves have also started making pandemic relevant merch, both with some generic and pattern designs that they have with MLS and American soccer licensing, as well as customizable options. They are making masks, not like the N95, but like the fancier like Bane mask that actually goes over and like wraps around your head with a little loop through the ears. They are making neck gaiters as well. They have a number of very interesting products for you to show your soccering pride and also stay safe in form of covering your face. Follow us on Twitter at LastWordSC. Email us at LastWordSC@gmail.com. Follow us at LastWordSC across all social media platforms. And you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. Just search LWS Radio or Last Word on Sports. You'll find us and a bunch of other great stuff. Listeners, we'll see you next week where we're talking about the results from the semifinals and looking ahead to the final.